I think this is the last talk before we have the closing thing. I see there's still some people trickling in, but we are going to start anyway. Welcome all, and thanks for coming so late in the program. My name is Arjen Kamphuis. I'm going to do a talk, basically an update of talks I did earlier, both at CCC in December 2007 and last year at Hacking at Random in the Netherlands, about sort of my experiences and some lessons learned about trying to change Dutch IT policies towards more open source and open standards friendly things. My house rules, the usual stuff really. My last slide will have a link to this presentation. So anybody who wants to grab it, you can grab it right there and then. And I'm gonna do this as fast as possible, so we'll have a Q&A at the end. Okay. How important is information technology and therefore software? That's my first point I want to make. Well, it's very, very, very important. It, you know, information technologies tend to really, really change societies, especially over time. The last time we had an information revolution, it was this one, a little invention by a guy called Gutenberg, who made it possible to create books 1,000 times faster and 10,000 times cheaper than the method used before that, which was copying them by hand, you know, with a quill and on goatskins. And the explosion of information that resulted from the Gutenberg book press changed the whole society. It created the Industrial Revolution, the Renaissance, new science, culture, art, all those kinds of things. It changed power relationships in society because more people could have access to more information. And after the thing was invented, we started a series of civil wars in Europe, mostly over religious questions, and that took us about 250 years to settle that. Out of that came the modern Germany, amongst other things, and the modern Netherlands. And so in 1648, in a town called Münster, not so very far from here, a deal was brokered and the modern Europe came into being, and here we have the modern Europe as it came out of that. Now, you see Germany is a bit messed up, because one half of the population killed the other half over the question whether the snake had really spoken in the paradise and stuff like that. But you can sort of see the beginnings of the modern Europe there. So information revolutions are one of the most fundamental types of changes that societies can go through. And right now we're in the middle of the next one. And, you know, we don't have civil wars yet, but maybe they'll come, maybe not, maybe we can avoid them. But the changes that will result from the information technologies that most of us work with and work on will be probably just as fundamental as the changes that were brought by the Gutenberg printing press. So machines have been getting faster and cheaper and more capable at a level of cost for quite some time. Moore's law has nothing to do with microchips. It's been going on for over a century, and presumably it will continue to go on. Even if we have an economic crisis or a war or not a war, that doesn't really seem to have much impact in the larger historical picture. So lots of practical things, even now, even, you know, 10 or 20 years into this revolution, which by historical perspective is really short, have changed. So we can now do online grocery shopping, which was science fiction 15 years ago. We can do online banking, which is something you have to be really careful about, we now know. We can get our music online, and of course nobody uses this anymore because we use this, which is because they have more, it's cheaper, and in many countries it's perfectly legal to use it, and it doesn't come tied to your iPod or whatever other device. So computers are becoming more powerful, more capable, and cheaper, and are getting everywhere, and they're starting to do things that are quite amazing, like predicting who will win a sports game, or writing short novellas all on their own without input. The only input here is existing digitized books from Google Books, and a machine has learned basically like a neural network to produce English language, and it's getting quite good. This is of course a nice example of an autonomous car. This was the first one. This was the follow-up model, which could drive in urban areas. And since last week, we now have the new model that can power slide parallel park autonomously. So if that's not artificial intelligence, I don't know what is. So IT is now reaching out to the physical world, where the physical production of things is being reduced to basically a software and a data transportation problem. You know, we have some of these right here, and the key you see here was printed last summer at Hacking at Random. by a 3D printer. It's the key to the Dutch handcuffs of the Dutch police. Somebody made a high-res picture with a telephoto lens of the butt of a police officer, and on the butt was hanging a key. They then put that photo into an AutoCAD program and then printed it up. The designs of this thing, you can download them online, obviously, and then you can print. It's all plastic, so it doesn't get detected by metal detectors. So as long as you make sure they cuff you like that in the Netherlands, you can always get away.
And it's tested to work.
And it's been tested to work, yes. Now, last thing, Mr. Craig Venter, an American geneticist and biochemist, he just announced last week, last Thursday, that he has created a living bacterial cell, fully functional, with 100% synthetic DNA. And he summarizes it basically saying, life is now a software problem. It's a very complex problem. It's not trivial. You know, it took them 15 years to build this first cell, but we all know how long it took to build the first Commodore 64, and after that, things sped up. So life is now something we can program, literally. We can program genetic codes into machines. Those machines can produce the amino acids that make up DNA, and then we can put that into other chemicals, and they become living, fully functional organisms. So we are way, way, way beyond the phase where a computer is just a better typewriter, which is how, you know, many IT managers tend to view it. Computers are at least as fundamental as printing presses, and as Dutch, the software that make them, you know, do anything should be viewed and regulated. So IT is the new printing press. It's also like a utility. I mean, internet is like, you know, it's like an energy company, or it's like water or any of those things. And utilities, of course, get regulated. So software is not something we can just, you know, let it go where the free market, if such a thing exists, makes it go. We have to really think about what it is that we want. There is no freedom of the press if one or two companies own all the presses. And in other media, for instance, TV media, in Europe, it's, you know, a concentration of more than 30% in any country is actually not allowed by law. But in IT, we find monopolies every day, everywhere, and, you know, often we actually think they're normal, which, of course, they're not, and they're not healthy. So alongside trying to think about how you buy software and how you organize your IT, historically, that's always been done in a very operational manner. So we think about cost, we think about reliability, we think about how do we manage it, all kinds of operational problems, which are very important, because if you don't get them right, then nothing else matters. But IT is now becoming so important, especially IT that we use to run our governments, that we should think about other things than just the technical operational issues. So these are some of those other issues that we need to take into account when we choose the technology and when we think about how we're going to set it up and configure it and how we're going to have other systems talk to it and all those kinds of things. So back in 2002, on the 1st of January, I decomatosed after a night of hard partying, and then I had to go to the Dutch railway site to plan a train trip. In Germany, you have baan.de. In the Netherlands, we have ns.nl. And normally you go there and there's a travel planner. You type in where you are and where you want to go, and it tells you, you know, how late the train goes. It's really nice. I must say the baan.de is significantly more advanced. But on the 1st January 2002, I got this screen instead of the normal screen. It says, you don't have Internet Explorer. This site only works with Internet Explorer. Please go here to download Internet Explorer. And I was using a ThinkPad running Red Hat. So no Internet Explorer for me, obviously. Now, this is a public utility. You know, the Dutch railways are mostly owned by the state. There's one, it's a monopoly. So, you know, and I was a good customer. I had, you know, one of those Comfort bond cards type things from the Netherlands, which cost like 4,500 euros. So I was a good customer. So I was quite pissed off that I couldn't even reach their site. And there's no technical reason for this. Everybody knows this. And neither was there in 2002. You know, most proper sites were not were far beyond this. So I scanned in my my bond card and emailed it to them with a little mail saying, you know, I'm not very happy about this. Please change this as soon as possible. And I CC'd most members of parliament who are into transport policies, and I CC'd some journalists and the Minister for Transport and, you know, the Ombudsman and about 50 other people. So they replied very quickly that they had had a lot of angry email about this, and in 17 days they had a new website which did comply to most web standards, so I could use it again. But I got one mail back from an MP. He said, well, this is something I've been hearing a lot about, so would you please come and talk to me? So we got chatting, and, you know, one thing led to another. And over the summer, we wrote a motion for Parliament, basically a proposal for the law to be changed. And on the 19th of November 2002, this was adopted unanimously. And it says two things. It's, on the one hand, it says the software market isn't working. We have extreme concentrations. We have monopoly effects. And society is being damaged because of this. And then the second part says, to solve this, the government need to actively push open standards and open source, starting with itself as one of the largest software users in Dutch society, because government procurement of software is about 12.5% of all software buys. So they sort of can lead by example. Now, this was adopted unanimously because on the morning that it was put forth in Parliament, the American Securities Exchange Commission released information about Microsoft's finances, and it turns out that Microsoft in that year had had a net profit margin of 92% on Windows. So if you buy 100 euros worth of Windows license, 92 euros of that is net profit for Microsoft, and just 8 euros goes to paying developers and the guy who sold it to you and stuff like that. So people were quite unhappy about that, and that sort of helped to move this along, because the Member of Parliament, he is a member from the Green Party, and Green Party members don't often have unanimous parliamentary motion. In fact, I think this is the only one they've ever had. Now, then, because of the Dutch government was quite messed up in those years, not a lot happened for the first sort of year and a half. But then in late 2004, we had some news that the Dutch ministry was in the process of buying 150 million euros worth of Microsoft software for their desktops for the national government. And one of the things that you're legally obliged to do as a government if you buy 150 million euros worth of anything is you have to talk to more than one supplier. This is just a simple EU rule in procurement, so that many parties can have a fair chance of, you know, selling to the government. And they had not done that. They hadn't talked to anybody except one party. So that was a bit of a mistake. And there's one civil servant was very pissed off about that, so he leaked that information to me and some other people. And then we pushed it on to yet other people, and so it got in all the IT news magazines. Over the weekend, we wrote some questions to be asked in Parliament, and then the next Tuesday, they were asked in Parliament, and by Friday, the contract was dead in the water. And it made Slashdot, and it sort of brought to the forefront and brought to a broader public attention that we have a real problem. But the best thing is that then most of the government actually went on vacation, but a few civil servants, of course, were there between Christmas and New Year. And so they were able to write a little piece on the problem that normally wouldn't have gotten through sort of the system. But now, because most people were on vacation, it did get through. And in this system, it says, we have a problem. We are effectively addicted to Microsoft and other proprietary software. And this is a problem, and the way out of this problem is to adopt more open standards and use of open source. And it actually used words like vendor lock and monopolists. Now, and of course, we all know that, you know, with any addiction, the first step out of the addiction is to admitting you have a problem. So we had the first step there, which was, of course, a great breakthrough. Now, from then on, we basically had a multi-year slow process of building the dossier, both with media and in the policy sphere, to get enough examples of what you could do and how this could actually help solve problems. And this is just one little example. The province of Groningen, which is like a German Bund, sort of an area of the country, was working towards a new IT policy. And it had only one line of text on open source. And it says, well, we're not going to use any open source because there's no support for open source. No company support it. And I was like, excuse me, you may have heard of IBM, but you know, they do something with computers for the last 80 years. But they hadn't taken that into account. So me and a few other people requested that we would be allowed to speak to the provincial council for 4 minutes, which you can do as a citizen. And we were allowed that. You have to, you know, report in a month in advance, and there's a whole lot of paperwork, but you can do that. And so we did. Four people each spoke for 4 minutes. And the difference was that in their new policy plan, it says, oh, we're going to use open office and open standards will now be mandatory and we want to support the local knowledge economy by employing open source people that we hire within our region. And basically all the good stuff was in there. And so the difference between the one and the two is just four people taking a day out to travel up there to be prepared, because you need to prepare for those 4 minutes. Basically, I take a rule of thumb that you need to sort of 1 or 2 hours of preparation for every minute that you're going to talk in these types of situations. You have to really think about it. But then you can do a lot in 4 minutes, and you can tell a lot. And many of the things that we said, like alternatives exist. They are free. They are functionally just as good for the things that you do as the stuff you now buy for lots of money. And if you stop buying the stuff for lots of money, you could maybe hire local people and lessen your regional unemployment. It's very, very obvious stuff. But for most politicians, this is like seeing the light, literally. And so they did, a little bit at least. So just to give people a grasp of the scale, this is the image I took with me when I went to talk to the Dutch Minister for Economic Affairs for the first time. We had printed this out on a large sort of, you know, foam board, and we gave it to him. And we said, well, this is basically what we're doing. We are importing 1.2% of our gross national product worth of proprietary software, mostly from America. So it basically means that if we would stop doing that as a society, for the money that we then save, we could hire as many developers as Microsoft has on their payroll. And we wouldn't be spending a cent more than what we're doing right now. And they would all be Dutch, and they would all be paying taxes in the Netherlands, and then their salaries would go to, you know, local Dutch whatever. So this is the scope of the problem. And this is also the economic opportunity. So this is how you convince an economics minister who knows nothing about IT but a lot about economics. This number is growing by 9% to 13% per year. So last year, the Dutch economy contracted by 3.5% because we are just like Germany, an export economy. But our software imports grew by 9%. And of course, if the economy is growing by 2% or 3% or 4%, so if we're doing really well, the software imports are growing up to 12% per year. What that means is that it is completely unsustainable. You can do this for a while, you know, you can spend 1.2% of your gross national product on software and maybe 3% or 5%, but things will start to hurt really fast, really soon. So you need to slow this process down and, of course, optimally reverse it and say, you know, reduce this by half. Also, this amount of money is about 3 times what we spend on higher education. So again, there's a bit of an opportunity there if you strive to be a knowledge economy. So these are some of the images that I use to explain to non-IT sort of senior civil servants and politicians what open standards is about. And open standards is just a common language so you can all understand each other, so you can finish those big e-government projects properly on time and within budget. And, you know, we know from history that having a shared language for big building projects is really important. So this is something they can understand. Now, to just understand how important those open standards are, I always use this, and of course the Netherlands still has the largest container shipping harbor on this side of the planet, although we've been overtaken by Singapore, I think. Shipping containers are like the important middle layer in international commerce and in sort of globalization. So you take a standard shipping container and you can put a data center in it, or sacks of grain or trees or, you know, whatever high-end products, or and you can put it on various modes of transportation. And the great thing is that the guy filling the container doesn't have to know how many different modes of transportation will be used or in what order or anything. You just have a standard shipping container. And the guy driving the truck doesn't care whether the container is filled with the data center or trees. A container is a container. So this is a very modular thing. Before containers happened, you had unloading a ship was a really complex job, and that was customized to the load. Now we can standardize it so the cost drops and the flexibility goes up. So this is sort of like how the internet works, where you have millions and millions of computers manufactured by thousands of different manufacturers, and they can all communicate using all these services like email or web or voice over IP or 1,000 other services. And they can do this because there's this middle layer of open standards that allows them to all communicate and play by the same rules. So the middle layer is really important if you want to have large, complex, heterogeneous infrastructures, which is, of course, what all government want to have and need to have to function. So services, this is the stuff that politicians like to talk about. What does it do for you? And the devices and the software, which is what techies like to talk about. You know, the shiny things, things you can pick up and beautiful. But it's the middle layer. It's the open standard where the real action is. And if you get that right, then you have a sporting chance of making something. If you don't get that right, then either it doesn't work or you need to buy everything from a single vendor, and probably even then it won't work. This is what reality has taught us. So The problem with vendor lock is that you have different layers in your technology stack that are tied together by proprietary protocols, and thus it reduces your ability to freely choose between different solutions from competing vendors. So hardware is a fairly good working market. You can buy laptops and servers and devices from a range of vendors. They have comparable things that they do for comparable prices, and they compete, and you know, it's great. So prices are dropping all the time. You know, computers used to cost 20,000 euros, and they're now down to a couple of hundred. But the middle part, sort of OS layers, applications, they tend to be tied up. And so we don't see prices coming down. In fact, you know, originally the desktop operating system used to be a fraction of a percent of the total cost of a PC. It is now more than half with if you buy sort of a high-end Windows version, for instance. So this is becoming stranger and stranger. And then, of course, if that entire middle part of your technology stack is determined by a vendor whose interest is it to sell you as much as possible, as often as possible, then are you really in charge of the really important stuff, which is the stuff on top, which is the stuff that you do with IT? Because if you can't choose the middle layer, then how much, you know, space do you have to choose in the top layer? Now, if you do nothing, things will get worse. This is a simple economic reality because it is in the interest of the software vendor to sell you more and more stuff, and the best way they can do that is to lock you down more and more. And if you've seen the differences between, you know, Windows 3.11, Windows 95, Windows XP, and Windows Vista, you can sort of see the process of tying Windows down into the hardware with all kinds of crypto things and, you know, supposedly to prevent piracy, but it does all kind of other stuff too. And this is actually a very conscious design. And it's not just Microsoft doing this, but this is a very visible example. So what you should strive for is to separate out these layers. And you basically have two flavors of software in any organization, generic and non-generic. Generic is the stuff that everybody has. It's a web server, databases, word processors, all the stuff that most of us need to have, no matter what kind of organization you are. And most of this, that kind of generic stuff is available as open source. Not everything, there's no AutoCAD version, but most of it is. And then there's special stuff, the stuff that makes your organization special. So the city of Amsterdam has a custom application to manage the maintenance of their sewer systems. Nobody else can use it or needs it, but they need it, and it needs to be precisely do that one thing for them, and they need to control it. So that they need to own themselves, and they need to own the source code so that they can adapt it and hire somebody to improve it for them. So those are the two flavors, and that means essentially that pretty much everything you own or use should be and could be open source. Now, in 2007, the parliamentary motion that I co-authored in 2002 became national policy. And the policy has three core bits. It says we need to improve interoperability by open standards because all the government systems need to be able to talk to each other for functional reasons. We need to become less dependent on the vendors because it is too expensive and it's just not strategic. And what we need to do is if we spend public funds to buy IT as a government, we need to make sure that as much as those funds as possible go into the local economy to support our own, you know, development as a country. Now, these are all fairly practical and operational. So if it were up to me, we would have some more political things in there, but that was considered to be politically sort of not doable in 2007. So I'm now working on sort of the next version of this, and I'll go into that a little bit in a minute. Now, the big risk with these kinds of things, because there are long processes, is that you're fighting the last war. So one of the things that we did for a bit, I think, in retrospect, is we were fighting the last war. So we were trying to help governments to switch from Microsoft Word to OpenOffice and to make open document format the standard file format in government, which actually we have achieved now. But the problem is that the real vendor lock-in has already moved away from the word processor and operating system tie-in to a higher level application, things like SharePoint, which has some problems, as you can see. So while actually some governments were switching from Microsoft Office to OpenOffice, which is very commendable that they were doing that, they were also implementing SharePoint as the single document management, you know, collaboration system throughout their entire organization. And of course, SharePoint then doesn't work with OpenOffice, and so you're back to square one again. So it is very important that as technology itself changes, that you sort of oversee the battlefield and make sure you're not fighting the last battle while very clever marketeers and well-funded companies have already moved on to something else. So this is one of the important lessons for me of the last three, 4 years, I think. So I've helped implement within the Dutch government a French open source project called XWiki. It is basically an enterprise wiki used for document management, collaboration, discussions, all kinds of things. It's being implemented in France in organizations with up to 200,000 users, so it scales up. And that can do all the things that a thing like SharePoint can do, except it's open source and, you know, you have all those freedoms. So two local governments tried to do a project where they were going to switch from Microsoft Office to OpenOffice, and they both failed. And they both failed essentially for the same reason. And the reason was is that they approached this as a technical problem. And this is where I think the current sort of policy doesn't go far enough. They approached it as a technical problem. You know, we have that word processor, and now we're going to have the other one. And so the new one needs to prove that it's cheaper than the old one, and it needs to prove that it works just as well, and that the users don't become unhappy, and all those kinds of things. And other aspects are not going to come into the discussion. So the aspect of a government actually being in control of its own source codes that run the government, they were not entered into the discussion. The consequence of this was, as soon as they ran into a bunch of technical problems, chiefly being integrating OpenOffice with a bunch of back-end proprietary pieces of software from vendors who were Microsoft business partners and who bluntly refused to provide any interoperability data, then they ran into problems, and so those projects were killed, regrettably. Even though they, you know, OpenOffice functionally does everything that a civil servant needs to do. But there's a business partner who provides a back-end application, and you know, they get a kickback on all Microsoft licenses that are sold there. And so it's not really in their interest to facilitate the switch to OpenOffice. So this is another thing, another example of a battle. While sort of we were talking about desktop applications back in 2004, of course, this revolution happened. All kinds of new applications. And so more and more people saying, are we going to do interoperability by moving everybody to the cloud? So we're going to abolish the entire word processor and just do all government stuff in Google Docs. Now, I don't use Google Docs personally. I think it's probably fine if you're using, you know, if you have like a little sports club in your area and you want to do the administrative process. But I wouldn't want my entire national government infrastructure to be on a server somewhere in another country where I don't know, owned by a private company, again, from another country. You know, that's that sort of, there's something wrong with that, I think. I think it's not strategic to outsource your strategic information infrastructure of a nation to one or two private companies. So even though these things may have great uses and a lot of fun, I don't think they are, in their current form, suitable for government use if we take concepts as national sovereignty seriously. So this is not the way to build the national communications infrastructures, even though Twitter, of course, is a very hip thing to do. Social media are pretty cool, and I'm sure they have their uses. I'm also sure we haven't figured out most of those, but I think there's still a lot to learn. But my biggest beef with them is that essentially these are old-style centralized services. So I don't know if anybody saw this morning's talk by Mr. Farr. I thought that was excellent, that sort of, you know, something like Facebook and Twitter really is a utility, because you have to go to them if you, you know, once you're sort of signed up to it. So this is, you know, one of those really good ideas. We'll have to see what comes out of it, but I think this is pretty cool, just to create your own alternatives. Now, where we are now in the Netherlands, so we've had a couple of sort of false starts with implementing this open source policy. We had a couple of good starts as well, don't get me wrong. You know, really cool things are happening, but we had a couple of failures, and they were, of course, broadly spaced out in the press, especially by business partners of the proprietary software companies. But the great thing that happened is this. We had a global economic meltdown, financial anyway, and so now the Dutch government has to save 35 billion euros every year, and a significant chunk of that comes out of their own internal administrative processes. So the chief information officers of the Dutch ministries now have a very simple choice. Either they stop buying €1 billion worth of software licenses every year, or they start firing colleagues, because that's the only two variables, basically, where they can move. So suddenly, there's a renewed interest in open source, in my personal view, for all the wrong reasons, but, you know, never waste a good crisis. So this is the primary thing that I think is really, really important, probably more important than all the other things which are of a more operational thing. So it's about this. It's about the fact that back in 1648, when our nation states, you know, became in existence, we made a couple of agreements about what is a government, what is the role of a government, and what is the relationship of us as citizens with our government. So that's the modern Europe. In a modern nation state, the laws and the policies of that country become real through software. So if new social laws are, you know, enacted about who gets a disabilities benefit when you become sick, then that law only becomes reality when the software in the tax system is, you know, adopted, and when the PCs of the civil servants can actually talk to that system. So it's in software that laws, many laws, and at least become reality on all kinds of levels. And therefore, anybody who has any control over these systems, because, for instance, you own the source code, then you therefore have a lot of input and power over that state. And this is now, of course, becoming at a level that is weird. Again, Microsoft has the power to remotely shut down PCs. Now, most of the desktops of most civil servants, of course, run on Windows, which means that basically from the US you can shut down most Western European governments. Because if you were to shut down all European Windows PCs and governments, you'd pretty much shut down the government. I mean, there's very little that a government can actually do day-to-day operationally if none of their PCs work. So this is no longer a technical operational problem, although it is still also a technical operational problem. It is now a matter of national sovereignty, national security. So making open source mandatory might not be a crazy idea. If a government, you know, works for us ultimately and is not doesn't work for its American partner, but works for us and is doing things on behalf of us, then they should have control over the systems that they use, full control, which you, of course, can only have if you have the source code of the software, so you can check it, you can compile it yourself, and things like that. That's not the end of the story, but it is a crucial part of the story. So I think that anything that is critical to government functioning should be open source. And so that we, the citizens, can check it, and that our government can check it, or they can hire people to do so, so that, you know, we stay in control of what it is that we do with information. So governments do all the really important stuff in society because, you know, if it's not so important, then we give it to a company because they can usually do it for less money. But if it's really, really important, like the, you know, national defense and energy infrastructures, the police, courts, stuff like that, that we reserve for governments. They're usually not so efficient, but, you know, at least we have some semblance of democracy and we have some sort of way of changing them a little bit. So this, in practice, seems to be the better solution. So the French Gendarmerie was one of the first large European government organizations that is switching over all its desktop to open source technology platforms. And the strategic reasons are very important. They're also saving a ton of money, which is great because that means that the project pays for itself as it is going. So that's nice. But the primary reason for doing it is that of national security. They didn't want to use systems that could have backdoors built into them that they couldn't check themselves. Now, the German Foreign Ministry has done the same. Of course, Germans are also so very nice people. They never say bad things about their presumed allies within NATO. So they said, no, no, it's all about cost, really. It's all about cost. But actually, it's also about the fact that they don't want to run their embassies again on software that may have backdoors, because there have been some problems in the recent past with certain, you know, foreign powers, big countries just south of Canada, using backdoors to get into other people's embassies and then doing bad stuff, such as, for instance, you know, making sure Airbus doesn't get a certain contract, but Boeing does. So, quoting liberally from Declaration of Independence is basically this, and I'm not going to read all the text because you're never supposed to do that, and there's way too much text on the slide, for which I apologize, but this is the basic idea thing that we should embrace. I love remixing the US Declaration of Independence because actually they nicked it from the Dutch Declaration of Independence, which was written 180 years before that, which goes to show that remixing just is a really good idea. So governments work for us, and therefore the software that runs them should also work for us and not for everybody else. That doesn't mean that nobody can make money. I don't care if somebody makes money off it, but I want control. There's two different things. So whenever the software doesn't work for us anymore but seems to be working for somebody else, we need to do something. And we need to, you know, design new architectures and new rules to make sure that information systems continue to serve democracy and not serve foreign powers, commercial entities, or whatever. They need to serve us first and foremost. So, yeah, if you want to see the full picture, you need to go to the Louvre. It's up there, so I heard. So, yeah, that's revolutionary. And therefore, you see that people are very scared to do this because commercial software companies have massive lobbying power. And when I say massive, I mean seriously massive. Europe spends something in the order of $100 billion yearly on US software. So when European countries start to make these moves, you can imagine at what level people are calling each other. And phone calls are being made from the White House to the national parliaments of various European countries, saying, well, if you don't do this, we might have to look at, you know, import tariffs on certain things you make. And so it's sort of hard dealing. But I think we need to push on. And these are long processes. So this is one example on how you do long processes. Once upon a time, long ago, Napoleon was riding along with his generals in the south of France along the roads. And it was a hot, sunny day, and they were all wearing these woolen uniforms, and everybody was sweating, even though all the horses were doing all the work. And Napoleon had a brainwave, and he said, what we need to do is to plant trees along all the roads in France. Then the trees will grow, they will provide shade, and then all our soldiers can march in the shade to the battlefield. And then they will come to the battlefield much fitter, and they will fight much better. So I thought it was a great idea. And of course, all the generals didn't want to be in the planting tree business, because that was not their thing at all. So they started to think up all kinds of reasons why that wasn't practical, or, you know, it wasn't compatible with the knowledge that they had, and blah, blah, blah. It's sort of like the modern IT managers, remarkably alike, actually. And so one of the most senior generals said Napoleon, well, you do realize, Mr. Bonaparte, that, of course, if we plant those trees, it'll take 20 years for them to grow large enough to provide the shade that you were talking about. And so he was trying to say, oh, it's so far away, let's just not do it, because it's going to take too long. And of course, Napoleon then simply said, well, of course I know this, so please start planting tonight. Which is, I think, exactly the thing, that yes, it's going to take at least a decade to switch from our entire sort of proprietary legacy stack that we've built our governments and public institutions on to an open stack. It's going to be a long, difficult road with lots of mistakes and things like that. But of course, every year you start later, you end later. And you start paying more, and you pay 10% more over your 1.2%, you know, gross national product software licenses. So, just to plug some of my good friends, last year in the Netherlands we had Hacking at Random. Some of you may have been there. It was a fairly cool party. We don't do those really big parties every year because we can't get €500,000 worth of sponsoring every year. So next year we're having a slightly smaller party, but you are all very welcome to come and join us. And we are going to do some serious practical hacking, both software and hardware, to do some of the saving that many of the problems that have been discussed today about makers and the last few days, about makers, about security, anonymity, privacy, all those things. We're going to do some more lecturing about that, but also a lot of more practical hacking, so everybody's invited. And, of course, if you sign up in the next 7 days, there is a code you can use, and you get a €10 discount. And all these slides are here, so I'll leave this up. And I don't know how we're doing for time. We still have 20 minutes till the closing ceremony. So thank you for your attention, and if there are any questions, I think there's a mic floating around somewhere.
Hey, just a concrete question. Where did you get the numbers for the... One was the $2 billion for Dutch IT imports, and the other you said I think $100 billion for Europe-wise.
The $100 billion is a 2006 EU piece of research from Maastricht University. It's an EU-funded research program into software economics from MET. So if you Google that, then you should find it. It's a thick, you know, stack of paper, a couple of hundred pages, but it has tons and tons of details. Of course, it's 4 years old, so you need to sort of, you know, double quite a few of those numbers, I think, or almost double, but it's a very, very solid piece of research. Most numbers for the Dutch economy I derive from sort of various sources that seem to, combine each other. So I have internal government numbers. I have market shares for various companies and their turnovers. And so they're not exact numbers. You know, I might be off by a quarter of a billion euros, but the 10% growth is pretty consistent.
Is the school system included in the government?
Sorry?
Is the school system, the PCs and in the school system, are they included in this by the government?
Sorry, the what?
Is the school system run by the government, and are the PCs from the school system also then in open source, or is this excluded?
Oh, the school system. The school system is, yeah, well, it is certainly publicly financed, but right now the Dutch educational system is basically a Microsoft Word training camp from age 4 to age 22, which is, of course, one of the primary reasons why we have a very, very high adoption grade of that particular product. So students, except if you study computer science at university level, except in that situation, then you're not going to see anything else than a single vendor, which is one of the problems that we're trying to change. But it's hard going because, again, there are a lot of interests. And Microsoft actually dumps their software at bottom prices in that market. So you can buy the entire technology stack for like 10 euros if you're a student. And then, of course, as soon as you start working in a company, your boss has to pay the full Monty. So like the cigarette companies, you know, get them while they're young. That's their model. And it works. All right.
What about security? If everybody has the source code, everybody knows the parts where you can get in the code.
Yeah, and usually that means that it actually gets safer. So if everybody can look at the code, then everybody can also contribute to finding the bugs and improving it. So historically, what you see is that any really secure system needs to be fully open source. So then everybody can look, and you know, some bad people may try to use some of the bugs that they find, but then statistically, more good people will also contribute to fixing those bugs much faster. And you actually see that in practice. And you know, I think the most famous example, and I'll go out on the limb here a bit, is the German crypto mechanism that was used during the Second World War that was very advanced for its time, except once you had one of those machines and you could sort of reverse engineer it, which is what the British did in 1942, and then essentially the war was lost because after that they built a computer to industrialize decrypting of German military communications, and by 1944 they were reading Hitler's post faster than Hitler was reading it himself. And that really helped in the sort of the Normandy thing to, you know, be able to real-time decrypt all German communications. But this is basically how the war in the West was won, by reverse engineering a proprietary crypto mechanism and then letting the Germans not know that we had it, or we, I mean, the West. But it is probably the most famous example of a proprietary system that is extremely advanced, but because it is proprietary, you don't have, you know, the clever mathematician in the UK also looking at it and helping you improving it. And we see it, of course, now in software. If you try to insure your server, one of the first things that an insurance company will ask is it a Windows or a Unix / open source based thing? And if it's a Windows thing, you'll pay more. Because statistically, Windows machines are easier to hack, even though there are 80,000 developers being paid very nice salaries to try to make it secure. Apparently, you know, a bunch of Linux geeks hacking away all across the internet are doing a better technical job, which is quite remarkable, but it's true. I would never trust a proprietary crypto mechanism because there could be a backdoor in it. So I only trust anything that's fully open source I can compile myself. Even though, you know, I don't actually compile it myself, I ask a buddy who is more technically competent than me to do it for me. But that person I trust, while the anonymous company in America I don't trust. I don't have a reason to it. Anything, if you just Google security by obscurity, you'll come to several pages who explain this much better than I can, with very juicy examples from recent history. All right. Any other questions? Then I think we should close up shop and move to the closing ceremony. Thanks all for your attention.